Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a podcast about design operating at many levels, zooming out from thoughtful detail through to organizational transformation and onto changes in society and the world. My name is Andy Pullane. I'm a service design and innovation consultant, leadership coach, trainer, and writer. My guest today is Thejas Chakravarthy, an operational consultant that focuses on people, process, and technology in that order. Currently, he says he has his hands full as the full-time COO of one company and C-suite consultant for another. His primary focus is on how we can make work suck less. And to that end, he spent 15 years designing instructional systems, the last 5 years expanding into operational systems, and wrote Brushfire and the Flywheel and the Lever. Thejas, welcome to Power of 10.
Thank you, Andy. And I can't help but blush every time I hear that intro because it makes me sound a lot more together than I feel.
That's the secret of my coaching experiences. Everyone thinks that, so that's the good thing.
Fantastic.
So we connected online and then we've had a kind of back and forth, mostly sending each other articles with, I can't believe this, you know, a new piece of research that sort of confirms something we've known all along.
Right.
But before we get to the work bit, I want to ask really, so how did your start in designing instructional systems lead to or maybe help you think about what you're doing now?
Well, that's actually, it's kind of a weird trajectory. So my undergrad was psychology because I was always fascinated with, you know, what's going on inside people's heads because I couldn't figure out what was going on in mine. And so I started going down like courses and taking classes. I never really had a specialization during my undergraduate. And then I happened to take a class in industrial psychology. And I thought, hey, I'm a really bad counselor because I have this tendency to simply say, well, why don't you just do this? And that's not at all what good counselors should be doing. They're supposed to help guide you. And as a coach, Andy, you know that you're not supposed to tell somebody what to do. They're supposed to come up with the answer themselves, and you're supposed to guide them to their personal answer. And I'm terrible at that.
Yeah.
But industrial psychology was the opportunity to basically say, oh, no, you should do this. But why? Because I say so, and because we'll make more money. And who are you going to argue with? But it turns out that that's... I was in college. I didn't know any better. But one of my professors actually said, you know what? You might be interested in instructional systems design. And I said, Scooby-Doo voice. But she actually pointed out that one of the biggest challenges in business is changing behavior. And a lot of people in businesses don't realize that the only way to change somebody's behavior is not by like penalizing them or firing them or yelling at them or, you know, giving them, you know, taking money away from them. It's actually by altering their behavior or altering the environment in which their behavior occurs. So I went down that rabbit hole, and going down the instructional systems design rabbit hole taught me things like, oh, well, there's actually certain parameters and certain ways to be sure that you're altering behavior in a way that you want. And of course, as is often the case, eventually I got to the point where I was altering behavior against the system. So there was the hierarchy, there was the business process in place, there was the, oh, we've always done it this way. And my counterpoint was, well, why are you making me build a training class when all we have to do is change the size of an icon to reduce the level of the number of errors we're seeing? Because that icon's too small and most people are missing it. I can't teach people to see better, but you can just change the size of the thing. Why are we talking about this? This is a non-issue. And that, of course, is the reason why it took me 15 years of just banging my head against that specific kind of problem before eventually I said, you know what? Maybe I'm done fighting it from the instructor side. Maybe I need to switch over to changing the systems themselves rather than continually having this argument, because training departments tend to be sucked under HR departments, and HR departments tend to be marginalized when it comes time to talk about business process, because the assumption is the HR person is not thinking about it in terms of cost-benefit analyses. They're not thinking about it in terms of, well, what's the overhead of this? What are the knock-on effects of making this business change, right? It's HR. They just do, you know, sexual harassment training, and that's it. And onboarding, yay, and 401ks, and retirement and pension planning. Not, hey, wait a minute, if we change this business process, we actually save money and save time in all these other attendant business processes. So that's what eventually got me to looking at operations. And for the past 5 years, it's kind of been like the last 15 years have been a nightmare, and now I've woken up, if that's the nicest way to put that.
Okay.
Of course, now I've woken up into a brand new nightmare, which is operations. And as we've both talked about over the last couple of years, or year, has it been a year? It's been about a year.
It's been about a year, yeah.
Yeah, with just Oh my God, have you seen this thing? Oh my God, I can't believe this thing. I can't believe somebody would do this on purpose. Did you read this thing about Northrop Grumman? Did you read this thing about Raytheon? Wait, did you know about this thing about McKinsey? I had no idea. And just, you know, so best that we try and, you know, talk this out over a podcast rather than continuing to scream at each other in, you know, in our own private internet problems.
Yeah, inflict it on everyone else. I guess we come at this from different perspectives in some respects, but it's also very the same. So I generally come at it from outside of the operations perspective in the sense that, you know, I'm trying to kind of, well, I mean, my main focus now, especially in the coaching, is to make people's work lives much more humane, you know, and for people to actually resolve the dissonance between the role they're playing at work and who they actually are. That's ultimately kind of what I'm trying to do. Where I think we overlap a lot is, you know, and you're obviously kind of looking at that from the internal side of things of operations and sort of getting inside the machine. You know, where I think we're, our big overlap is our interest in systems thinking and seeing that as a systems dynamic. You know, that you know, we are, I am trying to kind of help people resolve that dissonance, often while the very workplace they're in is trying to create more dissonance. And obviously you're trying to kind of do what you said, which is, hey, you know, I can't just train people out of a structural problem.
And I think that that's why we were put in touch with each other, is because we were both attacking what is sort of a fundamental problem in work and a fundamental problem that people are grappling with and have been grappling with since basically the beginning of the industrial era, to be completely honest.
Well, yeah. And so it's hard to get to this and actually talk about some of the stuff you're just talking about with the kind of behavioral change and stuff without getting into Taylor and without, well, later on in a couple of pieces. And some of your writing, you're then talking about, you know, Milgram and also the prison experiment. So where to start? So I might ask you about brushfire, and the flywheel and the lever. Which one of those did you write first?
Oh, so I released them, brushfire, then lever and the flywheel. But I actually wrote all of it at once.
Right.
And then I kind of looked at it and I said, okay, this is a lot to just cram into just one. Calling it a book is generous. I prefer the term screed or treatise or pamphlet, maybe?
White paper. Yes, pamphlet is probably the is a good
pamphlet feels
enlightenment kind of way of thinking. Right, you'd be down in some of your own printing press, you know, cracking these out in the town square, handing these out in another age.
Soapbox, screaming, sandwich board, the whole thing.
No, but I have to stop you there though, because they're not soapbox screaming. They are actually also eminently practical, I think. And that's what's good about it. You actually don't just say, hey, look, here's the problem and scream. You actually provide a way of approaching these things. That's why I was interested, because I felt like, if anything, brushfire is a little bit more of the kind of, well, as the name suggests, burn it all down, is a little bit more soapboxy or a little bit more screedy than the flywheel and the lever, which is much more kind of operational.
Right. And that's why I had to split them out, because I realized that where brushfire is more of a philosophical understanding of, well, why do I have a problem with this and why is there a problem and how can we approach this from a mental, sort of emotional, psychological, okay, I was going to say spiritual, but I don't mean spiritual, but sort of approaching it from what's going on inside in those few pounds of pudding that are rattling around in your skull. And maybe there's some thought processes that you can quickly lock into and just keep in your head to help you deal with everything at work. But I had that folded into, well, here's some basic steps that I think could help make a workplace more efficient, that I think could streamline some general business processes from a very fundamental level. So we're not talking about like, well, what software should I use? Should I use NetSuite? Should I use this? Should I, you know, talk to somebody at Blackbaud? I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about like, how do I integrate Microsoft Teams into Google Documents or something like that? That's irrelevant. What I mean is, well, what is your process? How are you rewarding your employees? How are you tracking success or failure? Are you using metrics? And what do those metrics actually measure? And I figured by separating the two of the sort of internal aspect and then the here's a playbook, by separating the two, it would be easier for people to pick up whichever side of the coin they landed on.
Oh, okay. Does that make sense? Yeah, yeah. So one is the gateway into the other.
And so I figured, well, let me put out the one that I feel most concerned about first. So I felt most concerned about the brushfire book because I felt that, okay, wait, maybe that's a little hand wavy. It's a little, you know, a little too, it wasn't, here's a series of steps that I think if you try, you'll see benefits to, and then, You know, you can try the more complicated steps, but it's Legos. You can build whatever you want. But I felt like Brushfire was more like, here's some paint and here's a canvas. And we're going to talk about Impressionism now.
So what's your central thesis, or could you summarize kind of Brushfire? Because there's, a little bit I'd like to read out first, because it's on two, I think, which is probably actually page two.
Sure.
It's right down the bottom where you say, and it resonated with me an awful lot, which is, wasting an investor's money isn't a crime. Wasting an employee's time is. For every team spending hours to do something that should take minutes, there's a child wondering if they'll see mum today. For every shipped product that has just managed to hit the deadline, there's a young man trying to keep his hands from shaking because he hasn't slept in 48 hours. So you start from this very, very human point of view. But what is the sort of fundamental thesis of Brushfire?
I think if I had to, and again, I'm terrible at this sort of thing. That's why it took me years to work through the books and edit myself down. As most of my friends will tell you, I have a tendency to wax rhapsodic, is a nice way to phrase that. Or just talk too much is a better way to say that. So Brushfire is sort of me trying to grapple with this almost unmanageable level of rage I feel when talking to people who just are trapped in a cubicle. Like, I cannot rationalize like that sort of dehumanization. I cannot rationalize the kind of just, well, people are products and people are cogs in a machine.
Resources,
right? So I grew up in India. I was, you know, I was a child when I saw, like, I was maybe four when I saw my first dead body, for God's sakes. Which now, when I tell my American friends, they're like, oh my God, that's so horrible. Meanwhile, when I talk to my Indian family, they're like, yeah, and go on with our day. We just have to do these things. But I remember very clearly watching a child my age have to go into the trash and pick up garbage and then carry, you know, scraps of tin to some other slightly older child and another slightly older child, until eventually they could sell all the tin to some tinsmith and make a little bit of money. And then I was like, oh my God. And so when we came to America, I thought, you know, oh my God, we're in the land of plenty. We're in a place where this is not, like, we don't see that sort of reduction of a human being to a cog in a machine. And then I started working in an office and I saw it again, except I saw, like, you know, somebody who was getting close to retirement, like a 65-year-old whose cubicle was decorated with pictures of their grandchildren, but they'd been there for so long that they'd worn parts of the desk away from where they left their hands. It turned a human being into veal. And then once I learned that what they were doing was simply automatable, simply something a computer could have been doing, something, you basically turned a human being into George Jetson. Just hit this red button and that's your job. Except you didn't let him do it at home. And he wasn't there with, you know, with his dog Astro, you know, and Jane, his wife. He was trapped in a box, smashing a button, as though that was the true expression of a human being. And that still pisses me off. So I wrote a book about it.
Right, okay.
So basically I wrote Brushfire from the perspective that if you ever are in a job or you have the luxury of dictating what a job will look like for somebody else, and you don't start from the perspective that human beings are capable of a lot more than you think they are, and are capable of breaking your expectations, then you failed horribly. And so you have to have a framework to harness what is in effect a random variable power source, which is what people are. A constant power source, something like a gasoline-powered engine or a turbine, is very easy to manage. You know, Henry T. Ford proved that. You know, everything was powered by one, you know, turbine. But variable forces and variable abilities, like, human beings don't work in one straight line. They work in multiple dimensions and multiple time frames. So if you can't harness every aspect of a person, then you've basically failed as a business. You're kind of curtailing their abilities and thereby curtailing your abilities. So it's a failure on both sides. You've reduced a person to a resource and you've prevented your ability to use that resource by simplifying how you use people. And that's, it's inefficient on both sides, and that's what pisses me off. And that's why I wrote Brushfire. Is, at the very least, this is a philosophical or mental model, a structure of mental models that should allow you to understand or allow you to see that it isn't as simple as, you know, sit in your cube, hit the buttons, and you do your job. It should be a let's talk about this.
So you've got this metaphor in there of the brush fire, of it kind of burning mm-hmm. through a forest. It doesn't burn the canopy, it just kind of burns through this mm-hmm. lower level of the forest. And that clears away a lot of undergrowth or overgrown forest mm-hmm. floor, mm-hmm. making space for new growth to happen. Mm-hmm. And, you state very clearly, this is a violent process. Mm-hmm. Why does it need to be a violent process for starters? Because, I can see that I can understand it, but I can also imagine people saying, feeling like, oh, that's not for us. That's too extreme.
Right. I think, so my stance on it being a violent process is, it's hard for people to realize how hard change is, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like by its very nature, as human beings, we're very change averse. Like we're risk averse, we're change averse. It's something that people have to warm up to and something that people have to be brought into. So I've known a lot of addicts in my life and some of them have had their moment, call it a moment of clarity or rock bottom. And then after they have their moment, they have now this urge to change. They now have this desire to be different. But you can't let a company that is the livelihood of hundreds or even dozens of people hit rock bottom before you make changes. So you have to make the change before there's a taste for it, before there's a desire for it. You have to make the change as fast as humanly possible, because you're literally changing the basic fundamental nature of a company. And people don't like to think of it this way, but luckily, one of the silver linings to the somewhat dark cloud of the lockdowns, plural, and hopefully we won't have another, but case counts looking funky. The thing is that people realize that, wait, I don't have to be physically in my office to do my job. Well, you actually never had to be. We've had the internet for a while now. Yeah. We've had smartphones for a hot minute. What made you think your job required you to be in an office? And in fact, some people are like, oh, we're more productive when we're not in the office. Yeah. A lot of people have been making that argument.
Or we're more productive when we do go in, because it's mm-hmm. a very specific thing and it's, exactly. It's a precious sort of time.
And so right now, there's a lot of companies who have inadvertently, kind of fallen into my lap, into my evil plans,
right.
Where basically somebody threw a match in their right. in their forest, and now it's on fire. And a lot of them are like, oh my God, how do we save all of the underbrush? We want you back in the office. Well, but why? Well, because we need to manage you. Well, but we're still having the same outputs that we needed to. So why do you need me here?
Yeah. And this has been the interesting thing, I think, of a lot of this, and I guess also underpins the great resignation. Of this idea that most of the arguments for why people need to get back in the office are from managers who feel they need to control people.
Yeah.
Right? There are reasons for getting together. It's not that kind of offices are de facto a bad thing, but it's kind of, if you actually, one of the things I do in coaching is say to people, okay, can you remember a really good day, or a week where you had sort of spring in your step afterwards? And what were you doing in that day or week? And then that's the kind of thing to focus on, because that's what energizes them, right? And it's different for different people.
Exactly.
But, and some of it might be, we were actually kind of really up at the whiteboard and collaborating, and it was really great. Mm-hmm. For other people, it's like, when I actually got the time to sit on my own and think about this thing very deeply and focus for, a few days.
And what's fascinating is the same person doing those other tasks, like the person who says, I had a great day because we got up on the whiteboard and collaborated, or I had a great day because I had time to myself. You could reverse them and they could say the exact same thing. They could say, usually I like to have time to myself, but today was better because I got a chance to work at a board. And then maybe their energy was drained because of something else. And then they say, I'd rather have a day to myself. And in a workplace that rigidly dictates, you have to be in the office, you have to be at this whiteboard, you have to sit down and think to yourself, no matter how you structure that, it's still a failure because it can't function in a rigid structure.
Yeah.
Because everybody, every moving part in everybody is going to be a little different every day. And again, it comes back to, if you homogenize people, then you make a mistake.
Yeah. Which, this comes back to this thing where we've talked about quite a lot. I've also talked about it before on the podcast of, management practices being predicated or basically just copying the industrial age factories, right?
Right, right, right. Taylorism everywhere.
Taylorism everywhere, which is, you know, this idea that people are inherent, well, employees are inherently dishonest and lazy. Mm-hmm. That's the first sort of fundamental kind of idea of that. And then the things that we are doing are complicated rather than complex. And so we can break those down into small parts. And then unskilled labor can be told, you know, to do that small piece of work over and over again. And then us smart kind of manager people, manager class.
Yes. Aren't we such a wonderful group of people?
We're the brains behind it who are going to put it together, and we are the ones who have integrity and stuff. And so it's obviously heavily, I mean, you know, industrial revolution in England at the time, and it's heavily, heavily influenced by the class system too. Plus, as we know, Taylor fudged his data, right?
Oh God, so much of his data was fudged. I mean, it's almost a running joke. And at least it was when I was doing it in my undergraduate, which at this point is roughly 20 years ago because I'm elderly. but it was almost a joke where we would say things like, okay, well, we're going to start studying at the beginning of the semester these theoreticians. We're going to read their papers. We're going to read their books. We're going to study and dig into their work. And then by about after the midterm, when we just finished passing an exam, proving that we understood them, the turnaround would be like, oh yeah, by the way, here's why all of them are wrong. Just like literally
pulled the rug from underneath you.
Exactly. It's like you studied all this, you memorized all this, we're sure that you understand this. Great. Now here's how all of this is wrong and horribly, horribly inaccurate. And here's the new research that shows that it's actually in a completely different direction. It's so annoying.
So that was 20 years ago, right? So
yeah.
So why does work still suck?
Ooh. Well, if I had to put a word to it, I'd say it's because there's more money and more safety and more security in maintaining the status quo than there is in re-examining things. So even when you look at software startups, my favorite example is to look at something like Google or any of the FANGs, right? So they started off as a relatively small company, but because of the nature of the internet, because of the nature of, you know, scale without cost, without additional overhead or minimal overhead, because servers are cheap and people are not, they managed to reach a critical mass where they could, where they had to start asking questions like, well, how do we motivate our programmers? Well, when it was five guys and you gave them shares in the company, they had a literal vested interest in the success of the company. But now you're paying people a salary, and all of a sudden you're like, well, they don't seem nearly as motivated as the guys who had shares. So we have to find different ways of motivating them. Well, guys, you just, like, did you not see how that math didn't work out? Okay, well then, how do we manage these people? Well, here's a stack of management books written by people going all the way back to Taylor. Here's good to great. This will totally work for you. Trust me. Hmm. You know, do Nielsen ratings. This will work. Trust me. You know, here's stacks and stacks and books of how to manage people. Here's a Harvard Business Journal article about management. Here's people with MBAs in management, and they're just going to keep maintaining the status quo, even in a digital brand new company, and then just recapitulate the problem all over again. And I think the issues are really apparent when you start looking at things like the CEO, Dan Price, who's hilarious and wonderful in my eyes. He's the one who said, I gave all my employees $75,000. And every employee at his company makes, I think, like $75,000, and he makes not that much more. And at the time, people said, oh my God, how could you possibly run a company like this? Oh, turns out he's got incredible great retention. He's got incredibly, like, his employees are willing to bend over backwards to help him. They've done incredibly well. And he hasn't changed his policies. He's just like, yeah, no, we're going to pay you what's considered a pretty decent living wage. And we're just going to, you know, empower you to do your best. And that simple dynamic, if you tried to do that at Amazon, I'm pretty sure Bezos would catch on fire.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that, you know, you'd see Elon, you know, drop dead in his tracks if he even considered the idea of, oh, well, maybe I should treat all of my employees as well as I would like to be treated. So I think the main reason is power, control, and the safety that comes from being rich and powerful. You don't want to necessarily rock the boat by saying, well, all my employees are as good as I am, and I am no different than they are, because that requires a certain level of
humility.
That's a good way to put that. Yeah.
But
yeah,
which doesn't necessarily go together with what is considered right. the correct characteristics of an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. right? They're not known for their humility, right?
Mm-hmm. Red in tooth and fang. Yeah, you have to be able to fight and win and destroy your competition.
Well, yeah. And so, that's the other thing. The language around that of kind of destroying and crushing and killing.
Hyper-masculinism.
It's
exhausting.
So listen, you've got that kind of very human side in the brush fire, although you've also got it in the flywheel and the lever, but explain what the flywheel and the lever are.
Oh,
because you quote Donella Meadows in there as well. And a few other people, well known in the systems thinking world. Yeah. You approach this from a sort of systems perspective. So, mm-hmm. what's the kind of thesis behind that? And what is the flywheel and the lever?
So I'm glad you mentioned Donella Meadows because my God, I love that woman's work.
Yeah,
but I recently just got a hard copy, not a digital copy, a hard copy of The Limits to Growth. I think it's like the third edition. And it's, without sounding too nerdy, it's basically my soaking in the tub read. Like it is, it is the book I read when I'm like, ooh, I've got some time to myself. I'm going to light some candles. I'm going to put on some soft music. I'm going to cuddle, snuggle into bed and read this glorious book, which is,
The only thing that I get with it is, someone was writing about this in the 70s. Well, actually, wasn't it late 60s they started? Did they start writing?
Late 60s was the first edition.
And here we are, just think, come on.
And yeah, I think, did I say, I don't know if I did, but there's actually a recent paper, I want to say in the last 6 months, where somebody basically took the exact framework that they did for the first edition of the book and updated with modern data sets and said, yeah, remember how they said there was like six potential branches? We're down to three. Two of them suck.
Right.
And one of them, if we work really hard, we might be able to pull off.
In terms of how things might turn out.
Yeah, in terms of how the limits to growth kind of like taper out and sort of plateau. Yeah. And I was like, okay, I'm going to need to read that third edition. Because I read that first edition, I don't know how many years ago. But when I read it, I just said, okay, I'm going to go in the corner now because I need a minute to myself. But after reading that most recent paper, I was like, cool. You know what? Third edition, I got to catch up. Anyway.
So I want to capture that. I want to go in the corner. I mean, part of me wants to just sort of go in the corner and cry and give up, right? Because mm-hmm. you kind of think, well, this is, they describe the kind of the complexity and the systems nature of it, but also they describe mm-hmm. the dire nature of what's going on in the world. Right. And it kind of very quickly hits that thing of talking about behavioral change where mm-hmm. this is too much. This is beyond my one single person's perspective. Sure. What can I do about this? So I'm not going to do anything. Right. I mean, that's obviously the problem that we kind of face with, almost mm-hmm. everything in the moment.
Everything in life, yeah.
So I'm going to go onto social media and just rant about it and that's it,
Yeah. Which is great. I mean, some people like standing on their soapbox in the middle of the town square and screaming, but I don't find that to be necessarily useful.
Right. But in the flywheel and the lever, it's mm-hmm. it's quite practical in that sense. And that's why I think what's interesting about you and your work is you're coming from it, not from sort of hand wavy stance, but there is, you're coming from it from this operational perspective. Mm-hmm. So I will get you back onto what is the flywheel and what is the lever?
So starting from my understanding of instructional systems, I eventually reached the point where I realized that instructional systems follow certain protocols and follow certain, rules of thumb. And so I said, well, what other systems design is there? And so I got a lean manufacturing certification because I wanted to learn how lean manufacturing worked because, hey, that's another system and that's another way to approach how things connect. I took a bunch of other courses, a bunch of other classes, and then eventually kind of tripped over my own feet into Donella Meadows' work. Basically, I think the route I took was by way of Banerjee and Duflo's work on poverty and the economics trap, which is fascinating reading. There's also a free course of it on edX, which I highly recommend. It's because it's free. And hey, why not? If you've got time, might as well learn it. So once I started thinking about it in terms of, okay, this is this large problem. Work sucks. Nobody in their right mind says, ooh, I love my job 100%. So why? And what about that framework can we look at and say, well, if you move this parameter over this way, or if you change this workflow in this way, if you tighten the spigot here and open it up over here, then the flows of everything are such that it should clear out this problem just by its very nature. So without any additional human effort, without having to have a policy, without having to have a, hey, let's all get together and do a ropes course together, or let's have a company meeting where we sit down in a big conference table and talk about your problems. Well, why don't we just change the business process so that it prevents the bad things from happening and supports the good things? And so that's where it came from. It came from this idea that, and so the flywheel is what I call just basically having a process that develops and maintains momentum and inertia. And the lever is the term I use to basically describe the processes you have in place to tighten or loosen parts of your flywheel. So I think of the lever as the intervention, and I think of the flywheel as the company. Because if you do it right, and if you do it well, there will be times where you're wasting energy. In the sense of, we've got all of these people, and we've got all of these outputs, but they're basically hanging around doing nothing. And that's fine. That's great. Because when you think that they're hanging around doing nothing, that's the time when people are the most creative.
Right.
Like, people are creative as hell in the shower.
When they have space. Yeah. And
exactly. Time. When they've got space to think and space to breathe and space to conceive. And maybe if you've got enough downtime and people are like, oh, well, you know, we don't really have any deliverables this week. No, we don't. We've got a bunch of them next week. Are you caught up? Yeah, I'm caught up. We got some breathing room. Hey, you know, there was this problem we were running in, like, over here in this other part of the company. I think we can solve it, and it'll probably only take us a week. Oh, well, let's go take care of it. That, everybody wants that. That's like the thing that businesses say, oh, we so desperately need people who can do that. We want our employees to take the time to do that. Well, but you're also giving them very restrictive, like 40-hour a week timelines and flooding them with 50 hours of work. Well, when are they going to find the time? You want them to just stay up late?
Yeah.
You want them to stay here longer? They've got kids. Or, in my case, they've got a dog. Right? They've got pets, for God's sakes. But, so the flywheel would be, once you start getting a pace in the company, you can, just like a bicycle, you can take your feet off the pedals and your bike will still go. And then maybe you put your feet back on the pedal and you pedal a little harder for a little sprint and then you let go. And you're still traveling faster. It'll take you a little bit of time to decelerate, but you're still moving fast enough. And that's what a company should be. It shouldn't be, we're going to be going all the time. Well, that's how people burn out, and that's how companies burn out, and that's how you waste money and waste time. And if you waste an investor's money, fine. You'll get more. I mean, you'll be fine. But if you burn out half of your staff to meet a deadline, why do you think you'll be able to meet the next deadline without burning out your staff again? Mm. And how many times can you burn out a human being before they go, oh, yeah, I'm not coming back, right?
So a mechanical flywheel is something that evens out energy, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, spikes and dips.
Yeah, it's a big weighted thing, normally, mm-hmm. a big heavy flywheel that usually, I mean, it's a very industrial age metaphor, actually, isn't it? But usually, you know, as it's turning, it starts to gain momentum, and you can add speed to it or break it or, you know, slow it down. But it's got a smooth kind of rotation all the time, which is a very systems thing, right? This idea. I mean, one of the things that I thought was brilliant in all of that work, Donella Meadows describes it very well, is this idea is you can push on a lever, you know, and it achieves something like, the example she gives is like GDP, you know, growth, you know, that improves lots of things. But if you keep pushing on that lever, you know, it goes in the other opposite direction that you start ending up actually, it starts doing harm, but because you've seen it do good, you just keep pushing in the same direction. I mean, we need more and more of it. And obviously, you know, growth is the sort of biggest example of that problem. Right. So how does this manifest in workplaces, that, because you talk about the necessity for this feedback loop.
Well, I think that what you, and I think it's sort of a matter of experience. I've been lucky enough, and I chalk this all up to just hideous luck over the decades. Decades is right. I've worked in a small startup software company. It was one of five people in a guy's basement. We made our own beer in the fridge. That's how small the company was. To working for the U.S. Coast Guard, which at the time I was managing the learning management systems for 127,000 Coasties out of the headquarters in D.C. And I've seen scale, and I've worked at a law firm, I've worked at a medical insurance company, a Medicare insurance company, I've worked in all of these different verticals, and I worked for nonprofits. And in almost every case, the issues that I see are that there isn't enough upward communication in the sense that upward communication is valid. What I mean by that is far more likely than not, especially in a Western, maybe just American, I could be wrong, it could just be only an America problem, the top-down mandate of what you should do is sacrosanct. Whether or not it's followed exactly is where the trouble kicks in. So even with the military, if a captain said to a lieutenant, I need you to do this, the lieutenant would then possibly do it or possibly follow the word, like the literal letter of the order, or possibly delay it because they don't think it's as important. And that's military.
Yeah.
And that's true in, you know, and God forbid you're talking about a corporate situation where some VP and another VP have a problem with somebody else, like pretending that they're better than me and taking my resources and making me look bad in front of the CEO. And then the CEO gives both of them the same order. Like, hey, we need to do this. Okay, great. Now they're going to fight at cross purposes and there's going to be all this other problem. But going down the chain, those VPs will tell their managers and those managers will tell their line staff, you just have to follow what we were told to do. But if the line staff, if the people who are literally at the bottom of the company, because if we're talking about a hierarchy like that, they see it as I am at the bottom of the company. They're not thinking about it in terms of, well, I'm the base of this company. If I don't work, nothing else happens. So they just feel like, well, I'm being told what to do. I'm getting pressure from on high. And then I have to deal with customers who may not appreciate or may not like what I'm doing. And I got to deal with that. And so they're sandwiched. And I think the core problem of that feedback loop is those people aren't given enough authority, autonomy, or accountability to push back up the chain and say, hey, VP so-and-so, you wanted us to do A, B, and C. If we do A, B, and C, it will cause these problems. So we're not going to do it unless you can figure out a way to bypass these problems. Here's all the documentation. Here's all the valid arguments. Here's our reports. Here's our data sets. Show us how we can improve this. Or push it up to their manager and say, hey, we're not going to do this because this will negatively impact all these other things. Or we need to talk about this more thoroughly. You're asking us to do A, B, and C, but the CEO is unaware that C is actually contradictory to the efforts of this other department that's doing 1, 2, and 3. And he may just not know and just be unclear to him. So I'm not saying that it's necessarily malicious from top down. I'm saying it's an issue of focus. It's an issue of understanding. A CEO should not be concerned with what the hourly day-to-day efforts of the person answering the customer service line is. But they do need to know that if that person says, hey, the policy you just put in place has pissed off 80% of the people I talk to, they need to know that. And they need to change their policy.
So if you're, you know, in many respects, because the ones at the top, I guess, have the power to kind of address the structure more than anyone else. But mm-hmm. if you're someone a bit further down, you know, and in that scenario that you've described, not necessarily the person on the front line, but certainly the kind of middle manager
right.
or, you know, kind of VP level, where mm-hmm. you often hear, yes, 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 but we just need to do this. It just needs to get done.
Right.
And then I just, you know,
right.
and then it has to be done by this ludicrous arbitrary deadline. Or right. And then the return comment is, well, okay, well, which one of these is a priority? They're all priorities,
yep. right.
which means nothing is, obviously. What
right.
can you do when you're at that level? Because I imagine some of the people listening to this, you know, there's
yeah.
a lot of designers,
yeah.
there's a lot of mm-hmm. design leaders and yep. managers and people like that who are in that position where they are under enormous pressure to hit velocity, you know, to run at velocity, have usually far too much stuff on to actually do mm-hmm. the stuff that they really should be doing and give it the focus
right.
they can. And often seem to have those conversations going, you know, I think it's a particular conversation that design people have with sort of mm-hmm. business people, if I can kind of make that crass thing, because design people tend to see things, not always, but often see things a bit more systemically, or at least question the question
yep.
behind the question.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And say, well, you know, actually, but this doesn't make sense while we're doing this.
Right.
And they're met
right.
with that kind of fairly hard answer of, like, yeah, it just needs to be done. This is what I've decided, or this is what someone else has decided is the thing to do. You know, what can you do at that point?
So I tend to look at those kinds of situations the same way I look at puberty.
Okay.
You know, in the sense that you do what your parents tell you. And then when they say, well, you'll do what I say as long as you live in this house, or you'll do what I say as long as I'm, you know, I'm in charge. And then you go through puberty. And during that time, you're yelling, you're screaming. I can't think of a single person who went through their own adolescence without lashing out at their parents. because that person is probably a psychopath. Because that's, I mean, that's the nature of adolescence. You're mm-hmm. supposed to get mad at your folks.
Yeah.
Which is something I keep reminding my friends who now have adolescent kids. I'm like, no. You don't remember what it was like when you were their age, do you? I mean, we were terrible people. But the reason I bring that up is when you're in a workplace scenario and you're in a workplace situation and you're being given a mandate and you're being told you need to do these things because I told you so, I think that none of people take that moment where they realized, hey, you're a self-actualized person. You are your own person. What's the worst they can do? Fire you? Okay. Is there only one job in the world? No. So the problem is that it's this, again, going back to the fear of change. And I've been in that position that you just described several times. And rather than just saying, I'm just not going to do it, fire me if you have a problem, which to be fair is needlessly aggressive and needlessly confrontational, I usually point out what you just said, which is, well, which of these is a priority? Well, all of them are priority. You do realize that's a logical. I need to know which of these I need to prioritize and in what order, because we only have a finite amount of resources that we need to deploy appropriately. Here are the resources I can deploy. And one of the challenges are that if you try to approach a operational argument from a systemic perspective, and you're dealing with somebody who doesn't see the system, you can't make them see your point of view. It's just impossible. Like, they don't see that level of scope or scale that you're seeing as a designer. But what you can do is understand that what they're seeing is minutia. What they're seeing is their immediate lane of information, and just use that against them. Because you can see the bigger picture. You know how to kind of sidestep the problem and laterally solve it. Well, then use your skills against them, but in the same skills that they're used to seeing. So let's use the example of, we have all these priorities and we don't have enough resources. Simple. Codify your resources. Make a shopping list. These are how many employees I have. These are how many hours a week they have. These are how I've divided out their time. And this is the end result. I cannot push them further than these number of hours. Well, why can't they work overtime? Cool. You're going to give me the budget for that? Well, we want them to do this. Cool. You're going to give me the budget for that? Just turn it back on them. Let them fight their own fight, because what you're dealing with is you're trying to create an environment, almost a biosphere, for your people. You've been given the probably the greatest gift a person can give another person in a workplace, which is, I want you to stand for your employees. I want you to be the person that protects these people. I want you to think about these people and what will make them happy. And that's your job. That's your job as a manager. Your job as a manager isn't to, well, I've finished all these reports and clearly we can see an increase of 5% in the profitability of our department. That's fine. That's hand wavy. The thing is, your job is to make sure that their workplace doesn't suck. It's just that simple. If you can do that, you'll have the best functioning team in the company. I can almost guarantee it. If they don't show up to work hating themselves, they're probably going to do better. So protect them by thinking around your opponents. It's not chess, it's checkers. They're playing checkers, and you think they're playing chess, but you're playing chess. Just think around them and solve, kind of turn them in on themselves, Aikido style.
That's a pretty good place to wrap it up, I think. It just made me think that one of the biggest crimes of industrialization was to put the manager's offices sort of not on the factory
above.
Floor, right? Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. White collar, blue collar, that whole argument.
Yeah. Well, also, you know, just separating people from the results of their decisions. And arguably, you know, I mean, that's also when the military goes wrong. I mean, you know, the Second World War or First World War being kind of examples of that, where there's this sort of distance from generals to the kind of...
Yeah, to the front lines.
Slaughter. Yeah, yeah. But there's... I don't in general like kind of military metaphors, but I think one of the interesting things about that was, you wrote it in one of your pamphlets, was this idea that what's understood at the center of that is actually in war, on the kind of field of battle, chaos reigns. Right? And so there's this kind of giving up of the idea of certainty, giving up of the idea of clarity, you know, and the famous... Plans are useless, but planning is invaluable. Quip.
Exactly. Yeah. And no plan survives contact with the enemy.
Yeah, exactly.
Probably my favorite quote from Mike Tyson is, everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face.
Yeah.
And so to that end, like, the thing I find galling, I guess is the right word. Infuriating is probably more accurate, because my face turns pinkish. Is this, idea that generals know how to win wars. Well, they may be able to make that argument. But the fact is, it's soldiers who win wars. Yeah. It's soldiers who win battles. And with enough battles won, you win the war. And I don't like using military analogies either, but especially after working with the military and realizing maybe it's not as clean as I thought it was. But the idea that you can pay somebody for their time, right? You're literally trading hours of their life for money. Yeah. And then you're going to waste those hours? I can't handle it. I just mentally can't wrap my head around
it. That's the criminal thing.
Right? That's just, that's a surefire way to make me just flip a table and scream at the top of my lungs. Is just like, oh yeah, so we have this person. They push the button. For what? Yeah, they push the button once a minute, every minute, for 8 hours a day. They take an hour-long lunch break, and then they come back the next day and they do it again 5 days a week. Cool, cool. So how do we burn this building down? Like, where do we get the matches? Where do we find the gasoline? Like, I can't. There's no solution for you, you horrible people.
So listen, where can people find you online and more of your thinking? Where can they find those two books as well? Pamphlets.
Oh, I'll give you the links. I do have a website. It's atrocious. It's just thejasc.com. And on there, there's a link to Hercynius and then also to some other stuff. I'm terribly not online anymore. In fact, I don't have social media to speak of. I'm barely online. My website is an atrocity.
Smart man.
Yeah. I mean, I plan to eventually change these things, but for right now, it's just placeholders and stuff. But if anybody wants to reach out to me, my email is thejasc@gmail.com. I'll give you the links to that as well. And email is the best way to reach me anyway.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
All right. Thank you so much, Andy.
As I'm sure you're aware, you've been listening to Power of 10. My name is Andy Pullane. You can find me at apullane on Twitter or pullane.com, where you can find more episodes and sign up for my newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you like the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes. It really helps others find us. And as always, get in touch if you have any comments, feedback, or suggestions for guests. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.